Happens in Idaho is a podcast following the trial of Lori Vallow Daybell. This podcast is hosted and produced by me, Kayla Waters, in correlation with my other podcast, True Crime Exposed. I have followed this case closely as it all came to an end here in Idaho, just 30 minutes north of where I grew up and currently live. I will be attending most days of Lori Daybell's trial at the Madison County Courthouse in Rexburg, Idaho. This is the area which the crimes took place, and this is the only location outside of Ada County that has access to the live stream of this trial. Each day, I will recap the trial for you here. Welcome to It Ends in Idaho, the Lori Daybell Trial. We're starting this episode off with the testimony of Summer Shiflett. This is Lori Vallow's little sister. And a audio recording we'll play of a jailhouse phone call that Summer has with Lori is one of the most gut-punching parts of this trial. Summer has been representing Tylee Ryan and is deemed a victim in this trial, so she is excluded from the exclusionary rule. She's been allowed to watch the trial and view testimony before hers. Summer goes on to testify that she first became aware that her niece and nephew were missing through the media in December of 2019. She had played an active role as an aunt and was close with Lori, but by this time, she was not in contact with Lori and she didn't know where her sister was living. Summer talked with Lori in February of 2019 after Lori had been arrested. Lori tells Summer that she knows where the kids are and they were safe. She testifies that she believed Lori at that time. Now Spencer moves to June of 2020, when the bodies of Tylee and JJ are found. Summer testifies that she felt lied to and the trust in her sister was broken. She also testifies that she video called with Lori in jail after receiving a request to call, following the discovery of the kids' bodies. Spencer Rammel requests to publish the call to the jury, which has been previously admitted as evidence as Exhibit 34A. Like I said at the beginning of this episode, this phone call is heartbreaking. I cried and cried listening to the audio. I love my sisters so much, I can't imagine the shock you would go through in Summer's shoes.
Not good. And how are you?
Not good.
I don't know what to say.
Do you not want to talk?
I'm willing to listen if you want to talk to me. I just don't know what to say.
I don't know what anybody knows. I've been in isolation for 2 weeks, so I don't know anything that's going on. I haven't talked to anyone.
Well, they know that they felt Tylee buried in a pet cemetery and JJ buried on Chad's backyard. And we don't understand how that happened or why. Devastated. thing. Either explain it or don't expect me to not be upset and doubt you when the kids are on Chad's property. I'm okay. I love them with all my heart. I would have taken Tylee and JJ in a heartbeat, and everybody else would have too. You know that. If they were in any danger.
I have no idea what happened.
You're right. Nobody does because you said nothing.
Because everybody sees what's on TV.
That has nothing to do with TV. This is when you're in my conversations before you left and cut me off. And now you expect me to be there for you and you were going to abandon me. And if you weren't in jail, you wouldn't even be talking to me and we wouldn't even know they were dead still.
This is your opinion.
Yes. I deserve more than that. I've been there for you like a rock. And I went on TV and defended you. I've done everything to defend you. And I still would right now if you would tell me the truth.
I would love to.
Well, then.
I would love to.
You didn't want to in October, November, December, January, or February when you weren't in jail. Why didn't you tell us then? What? You didn't call me when Alex died, which now I'm glad he's gone if he was a part of this, but you didn't call to tell me Alex died or that your kids are gone? Nothing? You don't think that's going to cause pain throughout our entire family?
That's never my intent.
Well,
you don't think I'm in pain?
No, I don't. I think you were dancing on the beach having a great time getting married. And you took pictures to prove it. Your kids don't deserve a burial, but you need to get wedding pictures? You don't think that's upsetting?
Nobody knows. I'm sorry, honey.
Then nobody knows except for you and the Lord.
Yeah, ask him.
I have. And guess what? I don't have one scripture that says it's okay for children to be thrown away like garbage in the ground. And that's okay. There is nothing in the scriptures that is godly about hurting a child. Nothing. And they deserve a proper burial with family that loves them at the least. I can't support that. That's hurtful to everyone. That's the most selfish, incredibly selfish thing I can think of. I can't think of anything worse. I don't understand. I don't understand. This is not my Lolo that I've known and loved. I've never even seen you be upset with your kids. I went to bat for you and said that to everyone.
I never have been upset with them.
How can you just go on without them, without any upsetness, and without telling us anything, and then expect us to understand?
Nobody knows in the world. Nobody in the world knows what I've been through. And I don't expect you to. All you've seen is what's on TV.
No, that's not
what he says. And all the influences of all the people around.
Okay, so now I'm deceived.
No,
everyone in the world is deceived except for you.
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm not saying that. I'm saying nobody's seen me on the floor crying. Nobody knows what I've been through. With my children that I love more than anything.
Lori. You were dancing on a beach with a smile on your face, taking wedding photos.
Yeah, months later.
You don't
trying
think
to go on with life, trying to be happy, trying to find some kind of happiness. You think I want to be alone?
Do you think that your mother and your sister and your son don't deserve to know that the children are gone? Why wouldn't you call and tell us that? Why were we cut off? You saying you want to go on and be happy? You're just going to be happy without your family and your life until you're stuck in jail and I'm the only one stupid enough to be your friend when I've been your best supporter, Lori. I've loved you my whole life. I still do. I can't bear to think anything bad about you. It hurts me. I don't want to see you in jail. I don't want you to be there. I don't want people to misunderstand. If you would tell me the truth, I would stand up for you for the rest of time. You know that I would.
I know you would.
But there is nothing okay about this. Nothing.
I know.
If you think it's okay, well, you have greatly been deceived if you
nothing
think
is
it's okay.
This is okay. Nothing about this is okay,
Lori,
Summer.
We have all read the scriptures. I know you've told me about a lot of your spiritual experiences. You know I'm trying to support you in all of them. But I am telling you, because I love you with all my heart, please consider that Chad has lied and been deceived, and that you have been deceived, and that this is not what you think it is. There's nothing okay about killing children. Nothing. And even if you didn't kill them, and Chad didn't kill them, and Alex didn't kill them, you threw them away like garbage in the ground. You, Tyler, both are burned. You, I can't handle the guy, and threw her in a pet cemetery. You know that's so degrading. How could you let them do that? I don't understand. It's so painful, I can't even tell you. I don't know what else to say, but please consider that you have been deceived. That is not Christ-like. There's nothing good in that. There's nothing good in that. That's not a test for you. You are innocent. And they were loved, and they didn't deserve to be treated that way.
You loved them their whole life and took care of them their whole life.
So why would you not be buried that way?
I didn't.
Well, then come up with an explanation publicly.
Following this audio, Spencer states that he has no further questions. Jim Archibald stands to conduct cross-examination. He starts by telling Summer he is sorry she had to relive that. She testifies that she is the youngest child of five. Stacy was the oldest. This is Melanie Boudreaux / Paloski's mom. Stacy passed away many years before this. Alex is the second oldest. Adam came third. He lives in St. George, Utah. And Jim asks if he was a friend of Charles Vallow. Summer testifies yes. Next, she says that her parents had a child named Laura Lee, who the family called Lolly. This child died at 6 weeks old before Summer was born. I found this interesting because Summer just briefly mentions it. They called her Lolly. If you think back to some of the accounts that have been attributed to Lori Vallow through this trial, you'll remember that she has an iCloud account called Lolly Time. Lori Vallow was the second youngest child, 2 years older than Summer. She testifies that they grew up together in Rialto, California. And Summer describes the relationship with her sister as close. They went to school and church together. Jim asks how Summer would describe her family. She says they had a good family with their own problems, but they all had fun. Summer recalls Lori's first marriage, when Lori was just 18 years old. Following that divorce, Summer says Lori married Colby Ryan's dad, William LaGioia. Summer testifies that Lori's third husband is Tylee Ryan's father, Joseph Ryan. Summer says that she stayed in contact with Lori, and once they were both married and lived in different states, they were more on and off. Summer also says that she married in 2000 and she has three children. Jim asks if Summer recalls when Lori separated from Joe Ryan, and if Lori protected Colby and Tylee from him. Summer testifies yes. I don't want to be controversial here, but sometimes I wonder about this whole thing with Joe Ryan. If you've looked into this case, you know that during Lori and Joe's divorce, there were investigators that were set to investigate if Joe Ryan was sexually abusing any of the kids, and they deemed that he was not. It seemed that Lori was pulling a control move. And in hindsight, I 100% do not trust a thing Lori says. But then on the flip side, I'm not sure how I feel about it because Colby Ryan says Joe was not good to him. Could Lori have convinced her son of this? Or was something nefarious really going on? This is a really hard part of the case for me, because I always wonder, did Lori kill Joe Ryan for his life insurance? Or is that the thing that started it all? She got a little taste of this money from a life insurance policy. Jim notes that during her phone call with Lori, Summer said, quote, You would have never done anything to harm your children. He asks if that's how she felt because she saw Lori raise Colby and Tylee. Summer testifies yes. She also describes Tylee as beautiful and witty and very talented in a lot of different ways. Jim asks if Tylee had health issues in her life, and Summer testifies that Tylee did have swelling of her pancreas multiple times. This is called pancreatitis. This would sometimes land Tylee a stay in the hospital. Summer goes on to testify that Tylee loved her mom. They fought, of course, as all teenage girls do, but Tylee could be sassy, and Summer always thought Lori was calm with her. She never worried for her niece and nephew. Jim asks, could you ever imagine your sister wanting to kill her kids? Summer says no as she chokes back tears. Jim asks if Summer could ever imagine her sister being involved in conspiring to kill her children. And Summer testifies no. She goes on to testify that she was raised to believe in Jesus, a good and loving example. She says this is what Lori taught her children too. Jim asks if Lori ever talked to her about multiple lives. Summer said both Lori and Alex mentioned it to her in late 2018. They also talked about multiple creations and probations. This was something new that Lori hadn't spoken of before late 2018. Summer said she wanted to believe her sister, but it didn't make sense. Lori did not talk about zombies to her, but she did talk about casting out evil spirits as well as the light and dark scales. Summer testifies that she was close with Alex. Sometimes he was fun and hilarious, but she says sometimes he was crude and obnoxious. He would often come to Summer's home and play with her kids. Jim asks if Alex suffered a traumatic brain injury from a car accident that he was involved in. And Summer testifies yes, she believed this really affected him. She says he always seemed to be stuck in a teenager mindset and would make decisions like a 16-year-old, the same age he had been when he was in this car accident. Jim asks if Summer stayed in touch with Colby Ryan, and she says yes. So Jim notes that Colby stated Lori spent her whole life protecting the kids. He asks Summer if she agrees with that, and she testifies yes. Jim asks if Summer would agree with Colby's statement that Lori changed after she met Chad Daybell, and Summer testifies yes. Jim Archibald has no further questions. The defense had planned to call Summer Shiflett as their own witness, so the court allowed the questioning to go beyond the scope of the direct examination. With that, Judge Boyce allows Mr. Rammel to conduct a cross-examination of his own. Spencer Rammel asks Summer about the time period she was made aware JJ and Tylee were missing. He asks if Lori told her she knew where Tylee and JJ were. Summer says that is basically what Lori conveyed to her, that the kids were safe. And Spencer says she lied to you about them being safe. Summer testifies, I believe so, yes. And with that, Spencer says it's all the questions he has. Judge Boyce says that will conclude Summer Shiflett's testimony. She is allowed to join the audience as she has been watching the trial alongside her husband. Rachel Smith calls the next witness, Richard Arthur Schmidt, and he goes by Rick. He is employed by BYU-Idaho's Public Safety Department. He previously worked at the Rexburg Police Department for 21 years. During that employment, he was involved in the missing child case turned homicide investigation of Tylee Ryan and JJ Vallow. He first became involved on November 4th, 2019, when the gray Jeep Wrangler was being surveilled by other officers. He ends up being assigned to interview members of Chad and Tammy Daybell's family. He issued warrants on Lori and Tylee's Venmo accounts. On February 2nd, 2020, Rick joins Detective Kunsitis in a search of Self Storage Plus in Rexburg, Idaho. He goes on to testify that Chad and Lori had visited the storage unit full of the kids' belongings on October 2nd, 2019. They drove a blue Nissan Rogue there. Alex Cox had also visited this storage unit with totes in hand. He also helped gather video footage confirming that Alex, Lori, JJ, and Tylee were in Yellowstone National Park on September 8, 2019. During Rick Schmidt's testimony, a lunch break takes place. As everyone gathers back in the courtroom just before 1 p.m., Rick takes his seat on the witness stand to continue the direct examination by Rachel Smith. During the search on June 9th of 2020 at Chad Daybell's property, Rick was assigned to keep his eye on Chad Daybell. Detective Schmidt testifies that Chad got out of the car he had been sitting in his front driveway, when search dogs were brought to the scene. He faced his backyard, watching as officers started to search the area where JJ Vallow was buried. Rick Schmidt observed Chad walk inside the home and return to his car with a backpack. Soon after this, Chad decides to leave the home. He stops across the street at his daughter Emma's house. From there, he heads south on 1900 East. But remember, officers were stationed at the church just down the road. This church sat on the same road just south of Chad Daybell's property. Before he can get too far, he is stopped and arrested. Detective Schmidt helped transfer Chad Daybell to the Fremont County Jail with Officer Eric Willer. He helped serve the search warrants for Lori and Chad's DNA, but he did not collect the samples. Part of this warrant included hair and fingerprint samples. When Rick Schmidt returns to the scene of the search on June 9th, 2020, he is assigned to help search the fire pit, where he finds teeth, burnt pieces of bone, and burnt pieces of human flesh. The evidence is all handed over to the evidence custodian on scene. He testifies that he also helped dig in the pet cemetery. It seemed that someone had poured quickcrete or some sort of cement over the top of the ground, making it hard to dig through. A backhoe had to be called in to start this search, and once that ground was broken through, they were able to continue digging by hand. Rick Schmidt was present when a green bucket containing human remains was found. Rachel Smith has no further questions. John Thomas stands to conduct the cross-examination. He asks about the surveillance videos Rick viewed, and he continues to mention that Rick worked the case for a few years before leaving the Rexburg Police Department to work at BYU-Idaho. He asks if Rick Schmidt had to refresh his memories a few times because he worked somewhere else and he hasn't reviewed the case. Rick says no, he reviewed all the evidence he collected in his reports about a month ago. Rick Schmidt obtained the sign-in sheets from the gun range, and John asks why he thought the signature, C. Quint, was associated to Alex Cox. Rick testifies that Alex had a license plate that read C. Quint. Mr. Thomas says that Rick is just assuming then that this was Alex signing in at the gun range. And Detective Schmidt testifies, yes. John asks where the detective was when the teeth were found on Chad Daybell's property. Rick testifies that he was in the fire pit area and the pet cemetery area. John Thomas says, generally, isn't it best practice to use some sort of grid and outline when sifting through something like this? Rick testifies that he wouldn't know. When Mr. Thomas asks about any boundaries the detectives were given, he said he wasn't given any. And John says, quote, just hey, here's a shovel, go out there and find some stuff. And Detective Schmidt testifies yes. John sort of scoffs and says, that's what it was? And the detective answers, pretty much, to my recollection. John says, all right, no further questions. Officer Schmidt is released from his subpoena and excused from the witness stand. Rob Wood calls the next witness for the state. This is Steve Daniels, who is a special agent for the FBI in the ERT department. This is the evidence response team. Agent Daniels testifies that members of their team prepared for a week prior to the June 9th, 2020 search of Chad Daybell's property. 8 members of the ERT were prepared and went into the search with specific roles. The telephone ping information was used to pinpoint priority areas of the property to be searched first. They planned to search the entire property, and they were searching for human remains. Some of the tasks of the ERT team would be a photographer who would take photos before anything at the scene was touched. Someone would start a crime scene log to be used whenever someone came into and away from the scene. Steve Daniels conducts the survey of the property before the search starts, as he was the team leader. There's 2 ERT members that were designated to the fire pit. This was a priority interest area from the beginning. Different equipment is used during this search, such as a Faro laser scanner, a total station, and a drone. The Faro scanner rotates from wherever you put it, and it scans the area, taking thousands of measurements. On the days of the search, this scanner took about 40 different scans. Photographs that Steve Daniels put together from the scene and search on June 9th, 2020 are admitted and published. Agent Daniels describes these photos as they're presented, explaining the Daybell home and property, such as where the fire pit and pet cemetery are located. A photograph taken from a bedroom on the upper floor of the Daybell home is shown. This window has a view of the back property where the burial sites were. Some of these pictures were of the fire pit where Tylee Ryan's remains were found, and these are shown. Steve testifies that aside from human remains, detectives also found pieces of cloth and fabric, as well as a Pura Vida chain and a silver charm in that fire pit as officers were sifting through. Agent Daniels says that the team was processing this fire pit and they could smell chemicals, a really strong smell of accelerant. A soil sample is taken from the fire pit to be tested. At this point, a mid-afternoon break takes place, but Steve Daniels is back on the stand when it concludes. During Agent Daniels' afternoon testimony, photos taken of Tylee's remains are published. A couple bones are uncovered, and the smell of decomposition was becoming apparent. At this point, it's decided to no longer use the backhoe to dig the ground up. They would use the hand tools from here. Detectives uncover a large white bone piece that lead investigators to an area they deem as burial site number 2. This is where Tylee Ryan's remains were found. She was found after J.J. Vallow, even though Agent Daniels is testifying about this discovery first. A tarp was laid next to where the remains were excavated. A photograph is shown. Agent Daniels testifies that you can see charred bones and pink flesh still attached to the bone. He says this area was more difficult to process because of the way Tylee was dismembered. The next photograph shows all the pieces that were identified as Tylee Ryan. Tears roll down Summer Shiflett's face as she watches the trial. Steve Daniels testifies that removing these pieces from the ground was difficult because they were all melted together. It was not a standard excavation of human remains. As the day comes to a conclusion on June 9th, 2020, the Rexburg Police and Fremont County Police secure the scene overnight, and the ER team is back on the morning of June 10th, 2020. A photo is shown of Tylee's remains placed on the body bag. Her skull is also pictured. The coroner and anthropologist on scene start separating and organizing the remains. So many pictures of the scene, the property, and the tools are presented during Agent Daniels' testimony. There are photos of a pickaxe and shovels that were found on Chad Daybell's property. Agent Daniels testifies that these items were dirty and taken into evidence. There are also photos shown of JJ's remains. His body was found buried in the pond area beneath a tree. Agent Daniels testifies that the area where JJ's remains was, it was noticeable due to the shorter vegetation. He says as the ground is dug, the investigators notice cut roots and disturbed ground. That seemed off to Agent Daniels. At this time, Judge Boyce asks for a sidebar. Afterwards, the judge decides to break for the day. Steve Daniels will be back on the stand the following day, Wednesday, April 26. That next morning, on day 11 of witness testimony, Steve testifies that burial site number 1 is where J.J. Vallow's remains were discovered. He also says that there was a raised berm in the ground. If human remains decomposed and that ground was level, there would be a dip in the ground. So this showed Agent Daniels that someone put thought into this. They created a berm for when the remains did decompose. He goes on to testify that once detectives had dug down to the black plastic, the agent swipes an oval shape over where he believed a human skull is. The black plastic bag was sucked tight to whatever it encased. Agent Daniels made the cut into the black plastic to reveal a white plastic bag. He does the same thing with this blade. A photograph shows the human hair that was revealed with this cut. Investigators now know for a fact they have found human remains. He testifies that duct tape is found on J.J. Vallow and on the plastic bags. J.J. was the first to be found, like I mentioned earlier, and they didn't know if Tylee could have been buried below him. They needed to be very careful. He reiterates that Tylee's remains were a mass of organic material that fell into pieces clearly charred. This was a huge contrast for the detectives after discovering J.J.'s body. Agent Daniels testifies that J.J.'s remains were buried so precise. The way the body was wrapped and intact, the way the stones were placed above his grave just below the soil, it was a huge difference from the melted, charred mass they found that they would ultimately learn was Tylee Ryan. The two recoveries were very different. Rob Wood has no further questions, and John Thomas conducts the cross-examination for the defense. He asks a lot about Steve Daniels' job, his training, and his experience. Steve testifies that he is a part of the Salt Lake Division of the FBI, which covers Montana, Utah, and Idaho. John wants the agent to discuss his first burial recovery, but Steve Daniels says he would need to look this up for recollection. He's asked by John about an excavation in Montana, but the agent says he probably shouldn't talk about specific cases. John says it goes to his credibility because he seems to have recall issues. The agent says that he will just say it was near Missoula, Montana. John asks why the ERT didn't create 3-foot grids to aid in their search. Agent Daniels testifies that they did create grids, just their own grids. For example, the fire pit had its own grid. There were about 4 to 5 other different grids on the property. When asked if the search included sifting through dirt or items outside of the fire pit grid, Agent Daniels says that he would need to check with his colleagues to see if they sifted anything outside of that fire pit. John Thomas replies, quote, "Well, we had about 3 years to prepare for this. This didn't come up over the last 3 years." And the agent testifies that he did not discuss this. John Thomas wraps up his cross-examination, and Agent Steve Daniels concludes his testimony. He's not released from his subpoena in case they need him in the future. Rob Wood will also question the next witness, Dr. Garth Warren, a forensic pathologist. He describes this title as being a person who tries to find out why people die. The main tool for this is an autopsy. Garth Warren works for the Ada County Coroner's Office there in Boise, Idaho, where Lori's trial is being held. This coroner's office contracts with Madison and Fremont County. Dr. Warren testifies that the cause of death is what causes someone to die, and that an unattended death is a death outside of a hospital or a clinician. He performed the autopsy of Joshua Jackson Vallow at the Ada County Morgue. The autopsy took over 4 hours. Dr. Warren wrote a report based on his findings in this autopsy. He determines the cause of death to be asphyxia by plastic bag over the head and duct tape covering the mouth. Another segment of significant conditions includes bound with duct tape, bruising on the arms, and abrasions to the neck. The body of JJ came to Dr. Warren in a sealed body bag to preserve evidence. JJ's ankles and hands were bound with duct tape. He was wearing red pajamas and black socks. The body was in a state of decomposition. This was clear even with his clothes on, due to the color of JJ's skin. The pajama tops, bottoms, and socks were all taken off and submitted as evidence to law enforcement. Dr. Warren testifies that this same thing happened with the plastic bag covering JJ Vallow's face and the duct tape that bound his hands and ankles. Nails, fingerprints, and other swabs were taken, including oral, anal, and penile swabs. Head hair, a portion of the rib, and two molars were pulled from JJ for DNA. This was retrieved by them and submitted to law enforcement. Dr. Warren testifies that JJ's head took on a green discoloration. The rest of his skin took on a brown leather appearance, and there was a lot of skin slippage with the stage of decomposition. Injuries that jump out to Dr. Warren were scratch-like abrasions on the left side of JJ's neck. Rob Wood asks why this is significant, and Dr. Warren testifies that due to the way JJ was found, it's a red flag. He doesn't know exactly why these scratches are on there, but he testifies that the first thing that comes to mind is, could JJ have been trying to rip the plastic bag off of his own head? Additional injuries include symmetrical bruising on the upper arms. There is a hemorrhage under the right thumbnail. Areas on the ankles look to be bruised, but could have been associated with the duct tape as well. With this state of decomposition, it can be hard to tell what is bruising and what is significant. Dr. Warren testifies that for this reason, they take incisions on the spots that show significant bruising was determined to be present, and that was on the symmetrical bruises, each on JJ's arms. Rob Wood asks if there were any signs of disease in Dr. Warren's external examination, and he testifies no. After this, an internal examination is done. All of JJ's organs were present and showed decomposition signs. Dr. Warren did not find trauma to the internal organs or signs of disease. A liver sample had to be tested for toxicology on JJ Vallow's body due to his state of decomposition. There was no fluid or blood to use. The toxicology report found that there were low levels of ethanol. So Dr. Warren says, alcohol. JJ's toxicology report comes back positive for the drug GHB, gamma hydroxybutyric acid. There's also other drugs in his system, like theobromine and caffeine. Dr. Warren testifies that theobromine can be found in cocoa or tea products. GHB is known as the date rape drug. It acts as a suppressant on the nervous system, but it can also be found naturally in the human body, primarily in the central nervous system. The amount of GHB found in JJ Vallow is inconclusive. There is no way for Dr. Warren to tell for sure if this was naturally occurring or if it was given to JJ in drug form. At this time, a mid-morning break is called. We are set to be back within the next 20 minutes. When the trial does start back up, Rob Wood continues his questioning of Dr. Warren. He asks to admit the autopsy photos as evidence. The defense objects. John Thomas says they are unnecessary, but Rob Wood says there is no better way to explain the autopsy process than the photos, which aid Dr. Warren's testimony. Ultimately, Judge Boyce allows the evidence to be admitted. John Thomas asks that if they are being shown, then they be shown in black and white. Rob Wood does not agree, saying that that is not a representation of reality. While the judge ruled that these photos will be presented to the jury, they are not going to be shown to those watching inside the courtroom. Prosecutor Spencer Rammel has to stand behind the monitor at the prosecution table to block the audience from viewing. Monitors are placed throughout the jury bar. The photos just won't be shown on the projector screen. Judge Boyce laughs and says he knew this many prosecutors would come in handy at some point. Everyone else in the courtroom laughs too, unaware of the photos that were about to be described. The first is a photo of JJ's body. It is what was found once Dr. Warren opened up the black garbage bag. Dr. Warren describes that jurors should be able to see his red pajama top and that it's soaked in body decomposition. Now a photo of JJ's lower body and bound ankles is shown. JJ was buried with a blanket, and the next photo shown is after the blanket is removed. Multiple photos of JJ's body and his bound wrists and ankles are shown. A photo showing a portion of JJ's face is shown once a cut had been made into the white plastic that was covering it. Dr. Warren testifies that a piece of duct tape covered JJ's mouth, jawline to jawline. A photo is shown of the plastic bag removed from JJ's face. It contains sloughed off skin from his face and decomposition fluid. Next is a photo of JJ's face. Dr. Warren says it is decomposed, it is green, and it shows skin slippage. The next photo is of the duct tape removed from JJ's mouth. Other photos of duct tape binding JJ's extremities are presented, including photos of that duct tape once it was cut off JJ. He was also wearing a diaper when he was buried. So the next photo shows this diaper. It is filled with body decomposition fluid and sloughed off tissue. A photograph of JJ's face before his death is shown. This photo helped Dr. Warren visually identify JJ. More photos of JJ's upper body and face are presented. Dr. Warren says that this is to show the state of decomposition his body was in. A picture of JJ's lower half shows scattered skin slippage on his legs and feet. Next, Dr. Warren testifies about a photo of JJ laying face down. This shows that there is decomposition involving the back and shoulders. The upper back and shoulders show a dark green color, while the rest of the back is a light green color. There are multiple white spots on each side of the torso. These are minerals, which are a part of the decomposition process. The next photograph shows partial degloving or slippage of JJ's feet. Lori Daybell refuses to look at the monitor sitting at the defense table as the pictures of the son she killed are gone through. Pictures of the bruises Dr. Warren found are pulled up next. He testifies about each one. The bruising is on JJ's bilateral upper arms, and the bruises were symmetric. The next photo details the left side of JJ's neck. Dr. Warren testifies at the top of the photo, the jurors will be able to see hair from JJ's head. He says they can see a slight or faint impression of where the duct tape was around JJ's neck. In addition to that, Dr. Warren tells the jurors that they can see multiple brown or light abrasions on the left side of JJ's neck. Next are photos of JJ's hands. Skin slippage can be seen by the jurors, and there is a hemorrhage under one of the fingernails. Dr. Warren testifies that this means there has been trauma to this area where blood vessels have been broken and caused a bruise. More photos are shown, and once the exhibit is complete, Judge Boyce notes that the victims in this case, meaning the family members, will be able to view these photographs if they would like to. This would be done in a separate setting. The monitor for the courtroom is set back up, and Spencer Rammel can stop blocking the prosecution table from the audience. Rob Wood now asks Dr. Warren more questions about the photos that the jury just viewed. Dr. Warren testifies that he believes the bruises on JJ's arms were antemortem, meaning caused before death, He made this determination from first simply looking at them and seeing that they were bruised. And second, they were determined to be bruises when he made the incision into the subcutaneous tissue. There is no circulation post-mortem, so bruises like this would not occur after he had died. I recall that Nate Eaton with East Idaho News reported about one juror he noticed during this testimony. While the photos of JJ's body were being published to the jury, Nate said that one female was looking away from the monitor and up towards the ceiling. She was rubbing her finger across her lips. He later notices her crying. These photos could not have been easy to see. They were hard enough to hear about. Dr. Garth Warren also performed the autopsy on the remains of Tylee Ryan. This took place on the same day as JJ's case, June 11, 2020. He testifies that this autopsy was different because he usually gets an entire body and he has a process that he goes through, as he did with JJ's body. Tylee's remains were turned over to him in three separate sealed bags. Two bags were body bags, and one was a sealed brown paper bag containing five more bags within it. Dr. Warren says he essentially received Tylee's remains in multiple different sections. This was a process of sifting through the bags and trying to identify bones versus soft tissue. He had to clean the bones and get them ready for anthropology. X-rays were taken of all the material to try and determine what kind of possible remains he had, how many bones he had received, as well as foreign objects such as a bullet, knife portions, or other foreign debris. Nothing was found within Tylee's remains. All they could find was a collection of bones along with mud and dirt. Dr. Warren was able to cut into skeletal muscle to obtain the best tissue he could and have it sent out for toxicology. The report notes that Tylee was positive for ibuprofen, as well as a decompositional product that is common in most cases of decomposition. A carbon monoxide level came back, as well as a carboxyhemoglobin saturation level and iron. Dr. Warren testifies that in any kind of fire death, they test for carboxyhemoglobin. They do this because the fire releases carbon monoxide. He says if that is then breathed in and the person is alive, you're going to get a high carboxyhemoglobin saturation level. Thankfully, Dr. Warren testifies that the level came back extremely low with no indication that Tylee was alive when her body was burned. Although he does state that the skeletal muscle is not the best option for testing, the blood is, but the skeletal can give you an idea. Dr. Warren was able to find some organs among the debris of Tylee's dismembered body. He found Tylee's heart still connected to the right and left lung. One kidney is found. A portion of Tylee's bowel is obtained, as well as portions of her liver. Small fragments of brain matter were also found. These organs were not intact and easily identifiable. Dr. Warren testifies that they had severe decomposition and fire damage. They were shrunken as well. He identifies Tylee's pelvis with portions of her femur. Portions of her skull, including where her eyeball would have been, are also found. He says that they found a portion of her mandible with some teeth still attached. The tibia and fibula from the lower leg are found, as well as the radius from the forearm. A portion of Tylee's sternum and multiple rib fragments are identified. These bones had significant damage due to the fire. They were blackened and charred. Some of this damage also came from the dismemberment of Tylee's body. Rob Wood asks if Dr. Warren has formed an expert opinion on the cause of death for Tylee Ryan. He testifies yes. The cause of death is homicide by unspecified means. The definition of this is used as a term for the cause of death when the forensic pathologist has looked at all the facts and totality of the case. The pathologist does this to determine that the cause of death was by homicide, but can't pinpoint exactly what that was. With an intact body, it's easier to determine if someone was stabbed or shot or strangled. At this time, a much-needed break is called by Judge Boyce, so the courtroom empties for lunch. At the conclusion of this break, Rob Wood continues the direct examination of Dr. Warren. He testifies that he looked into Tylee's medical records. Dr. Warren found that Tylee was documented to have anxiety with panic attacks. She also had ovarian cysts that caused her pain, as well as reoccurring pancreatitis. It would often flare up when Tylee took antibiotics. There is mention in these records of possible autoimmune issues being the cause of all of this. She was also known to have mesenteric adenitis, which would cause her abdominal pain. But Dr. Warren says that nothing in Tylee Ryan's medical history provides a reasonable explanation for her death. Rob Wood asks to admit the photos of Tylee's autopsy. John Thomas again objects to this, but Judge Boyce allows the photos to be submitted and published to the jury. Some photos will be published to the jury and the audience inside the courtroom, but some will be kept private. A picture of three sealed bags is shown. These pictures are shown to the public. But the close-up pictures of the remains are made private. Dr. Warren describes a photo of clumped remains within mud and dirt. Bones with decomposing tissue attached are shown, as well as photos of Tylee's hip bones. Pictures of Tylee's skull with some teeth attached are presented. Next is her lungs, heart, kidney, and other organs. They're charred and they show thermal damage. Dr. Warren explains a lung as typically soft. He says Tylee's had become similar to a hard sponge. Many more photos of Tylee's bone fragments are published, and Dr. Warren describes each picture. At the conclusion of this exhibit being presented, Rob Wood ends his line of questioning. John Thomas will conduct cross-examination for the defense. He starts off by questioning Dr. Warren about his education and experience in depth. Dr. Warren completed three different fellowships. He also testifies that the Ada County Coroner's Office works with the law enforcement, but not for them. John Thomas ends up asking if the autopsies were recorded, but Dr. Warren says no, autopsies are not recorded via video or audio. Then John asks why Dr. Warren did not collect evidence from inside of JJ's sinuses. Without that, how was he able to determine that JJ was smothered with a plastic bag? Things get a little spicy between John Thomas and Dr. Warren around this time of cross-examination. Dr. Warren testifies that he has never heard of anyone swabbing sinuses to determine if a bag over the head caused suffocation. John Thomas says, quote, "So when someone has a bag over their head, and I'm just going off things I've seen in movies and whatnot, it seems that..." But Dr. Warren quickly cuts John off, saying, "That's scary." John chuckles and says, "That's scary to you?" And Dr. Warren says, "Yeah, that you're going off movies." John says, "Okay, while you're going off of..." And Dr. Warren quickly says, "My knowledge." John asks if anything inside the plastic bag would go inside your nasal cavity or mouth and down the throat. When Dr. Warren says no, that's not how it works, John asks him to explain. Dr. Warren says, essentially, a bag is put over your head and you can't breathe. You go unconscious and you die. John says, so nothing goes inside your nasal cavity. And Dr. Warren replies, I don't know why it would. So John asks, then what are you breathing in? And Dr. Warren says, air. John asks, from where? And Dr. Warren says, nowhere. That's why you die. At the end of the cross-examination, John Thomas asks if the bruises found on JJ's arms seemed to be fresh. Dr. Warren says that a bruise can't be dated specifically, so all he can say is that the bruising looked fresh. It was red and purple. If it was healing, you would expect more discoloration. All he can say is that it's recent and likely fresh. John Thomas asks, pretty fresh, meaning days, right? But Dr. Warren says no, that's too far. It was likely around the time of JJ's death, within hours. The defense states that they may recall Dr. Warren, so they ask that he is not released from his subpoena at this time. But for today, he is excused as a witness. A mid-afternoon break now ensues. In our next episode, we will start off by recapping the testimony of anthropologist Dr. Christensen. Following that, we will hear from many other witnesses, including Tammy Dabo's sister and other friends of hers. This podcast was produced by True Crime Exposed and is hosted by me, Kayla Waters. Please leave us a 5-star written review as we are a new podcast and help spread the word.